This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Marco Williams grew up in New York City as a child of the Civil Rights Movement, went to a socialist summer camp, participated in be-ins in Central Park, and sold Black Panther Party papers. This upbringing eventually led him to his life's work, using film to tell the stories that many of us don't want to hear. His documentaries take audiences deep into ugly events in American history, like the violence of Freedom Summer in Mississippi or the systematic expulsion of more than 4,000 Black residents from their homes. Marco has won an Emmy and a Peabody and a number of other prestigious awards, and he continues to work on new projects. He's using his Guggenheim Fellowship to pursue a film about Black-on-Black homicide. He usually resides in New York City when he teaches at NYU, but he's here in this area as the Lehman Brady Visiting Joint Chair Professor in Documentary Studies and American Studies at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. And he joins me now to talk about his career and his creative vision. Marco Williams, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. I'm really glad to be here. A little nervous. It's a little strange, but I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to make it as hard on you as possible. Absolutely. You grew up in, I suppose now you could consider yourself a child of the Civil Rights Movement. I gave that little synopsis. Did you? What were you thinking at the time? Describe your upbringing in New York.
Fair question. I think that as a child, I was not cognizant that I was a child of the Civil Rights Movement. Probably sometime in high school, certainly college going forward, I realized that my life trajectory, the schools I went to, the summer camps, the experiences I was having were really born out of the struggle of the Civil Rights Movement for integration. I was a benefactor of that private school education. There were schools in New York City that desperately wanted to have, probably they were called Negro children. In their schools, they were all white. They were liberal-minded, but they were all white. How can we find a way to have Black kids? And I went to those types of schools on scholarship.
That suggested somebody at home thought that would be a very good idea.
I'm certainly the benefactor of my mother first and foremost. I'm an only child raised by a single parent. I really think that a lot of my mother's vision came from her mother, my grandmother, who died when I was three. Geneva sent my mother forward. My mother was the first in our family to go to college, although she did not finish college at that time because she became pregnant with me, which was fairly common in my family. I've made a documentary about that subject. But certainly, if it weren't for my mother's vision to see opportunity, who knows where I would be.
What was your experience like in those schools, the private school?
I would say that I was empowered. I think that the benefit of a private school, more than anything, and this is both reflection on my experiences at two different schools, three including high school, and my sort of reflection overall, my analysis, is that I was in a small room, I think, at City and Country. I was one of 12 students, a lot of attention, a lot of consideration. At City and Country, I was also one of only two Black students, a lot of pressure. When Martin Luther King at Downtown Community School, I was the president of the student council. When Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, I was asked to give the speech. So there's always that kind of dynamic, you know, you're Black, speak for Black people. But I certainly benefited from an environment where I was given voice, given encouragement, where people believed in me.
Tell us about those summer camps or that summer camp and how it shaped your politics.
Well, you know, I went to summer camp every summer from 7 till 13. Why? My mother was working. Summer camp provided child care. Sleepaway camp provided 24 hours child care. The last camp I went to for the last 3 years, 11, 12, and 13, was called Twin Link Hurley. I don't think it exists anymore. I refer to it as a red camp. It was run by Jewish socialists. It was a camp that was not built around fun, although we swam, we could play baseball, arts and crafts. It was a camp built around having conversation about things that were going on in the given day. If a racial slur was said, because it was an integrated camp of working class kids, We immediately stopped and had long conversations about the significance of meaning of that. So I'd say for sure, Twin Link Hurley instilled in me a sense of the importance of justice, an awareness of injustice. I learned freedom songs there, folk songs that I still sing, although I'm a lousy singer, so I won't hurt your audience's ears. So I would say for sure that's where it would probably, whatever was going on earlier was being sort of focused down into kind of the person that I am today.
I can sort of imagine this going, especially being one of few African-Americans in an all-white school, private school, in this moment when the civil right, when all of our consciousnesses are being opened, being in that milieu, not being able to pull it all together. At camp, in that moment, were you beginning to see this as kind of a political way of being? I mean, there's a difference between being part of it and then reflecting on it. And I'm wondering when the reflections began.
I think camp was still a place where certain ideas were being germinated.
Yeah.
Camp was certainly a place where I was empowered again. I was seen as a leader. But camp, I was not the only black student. In fact, in camp, I probably was an anomaly relative to many of the other black and Latino kids there. I went to private school. At best, some of those campers that I knew who became my friends went to Catholic school, but otherwise they were going to the neighborhood public schools. The community center that ran the camp was in East New York. There were some Jewish students there. They tended to be from more sort of middle-class families. So I was still once more thrust in a situation where I was different, even though I wasn't simply being asked to speak for the race. But I certainly was encouraged to speak and to speak out. And I would say, and maybe this is jumping ahead, that it wasn't until high school, it was really in high school where I was kind of confronted with identity and how to speak out, because there were some classmates or schoolmates who were far more advanced than I was in terms of these ideas.
Well, before we get to that, we're talking about these kind of rare circumstances where you're in private school and camps, all of which are kind of isolated. All of this then in the big giant cauldron that is New York City, where you are roaming freely. Tell us about your experiences on the streets.
Yeah, you know, life is very different now than it was for me back in the early, mid-60s, 70s. Look, I had to take a bus to school by myself from age 7. My mother one Sunday showed me how to do it. Sit in the front seat so you can talk to the bus driver, subways to all parts of New York City. So my life really reflected kind of the multiculturalism of New York City, growing up on the Lower East Side, a very diverse neighborhood, lots of races, ethnicities, nationalities. And school and everything encouraged me to find my voice. So you, in your introduction, you reference be-ins in Central Park. So I was a hippie. I had bell bottoms with tassels on them. But I also sold Black Panther Party newspapers. I was on 8th Street and 6th Avenue. So there I was trying to make sense of many divergent or different components that became my identity. And I'm very proud of that, that I, in the end, I'm very, very strong advocate of race and being black. But I have a real sensitivity to lots of things. And so that's what New York was like for me. There were no boundaries. It was all about discovering anything and everything. And that does come back to my mom.
We are talking to filmmaker Marco Williams today on The State of Things. Meeting him, talking about his upbringing, coming up in New York City, has done a number of films, several award winners. You talked about then being in high school, and your creative life begins to open up a little bit there as well. Talk about your entree into drama.
Thinking about, I was not a child of creativity. I hated museums. I didn't grow up with a TV in the home. My essence was the streets of New York. I like to play on the streets, ring alivio, roundup, punch ball, stick ball. So that was my orientation. I go to boarding school. Why do I go to boarding school? My mother does not want me to go to the neighborhood public school. I didn't get into art and design, music and art, Stuyvesant. I didn't get into any of the specialized high schools. I did get into a couple of progressive boarding schools. Interesting for me because in boarding school, I was interested in drama, or I thought I was, and I learned a very harsh lesson from my drama teacher. But I also was a place where I expressed what I had already learned at camp. So I was constantly getting roles in plays that were very old plays that called for a Negro dot, dot, dot. So I was a Negro chair pusher. I was a Negro this. And I was like, wait a second. You don't have to be, you know, this is acting. You know, what's the part? Let me play. So I challenged her and I got in trouble. I was told, well, Virginia is very sensitive. She will even sew buttons on the costumes. She put me in my place. She said, there are no such thing as small parts. There are only small actors. I realized that at that time I was a small actor. And so really it wasn't even in, I think, again, if you're thinking of my educational and life trajectory, Buxton High School was a place where yet the seeds were being further germinated, but they hadn't been planted.
We'll talk more about those seeds, how they germinated, and how they have begun to blossom with filmmaker Marco Williams, my guest today, who is currently the Lehman Brady Visiting Joint Chair Professor in Documentary Studies and American Studies at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today I'm talking with award-winning filmmaker and educator Marco Williams about his life and creative work. And before the break, we were talking about growing up in New York City. You were a failed actor in high school. You tried. And interesting that it sort of brushed up against your sort of newly forming political life. When did you develop an interest in film?
I became interested in film in college, and the reality for me is, A, not growing up with a TV. I was not really exposed to cinema or stories of such. I didn't really go to the movies as a kid. But it wasn't until my sophomore year of college, and that even came in a circuitous fashion because it was in my freshman year. I had to fulfill a requirement, as is expected, a humanities requirement, and the proctors recommended a class that they referred to as Monday Night at the Movies. So it was a gut, i.e. it was supposed to be easy. And that was a class on the films of Alfred Hitchcock. What does Hitchcock have to do with my film work today? In some sense, very little, but he was very inspiring to me. That class was not a gut. It was very, very hard. I can remember crying in my dorm room, not being able to write the papers. But a world was open to me that you could make, that cinema was a mechanism for affecting change. And although Hitchcock's films were suspense-driven, there was real intentionality.
Now, we should point out you're at Harvard at this time, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so it was a small college in Cambridge, Massachusetts called Harvard University. That's right.
Well, so there you are again, kind of in this environment where you're one of the few, or were you?
I certainly was one of the few in many ways, although I played soccer my freshman year. I was on the soccer team, and that was a team that was principally made up of white students from preparatory schools in New England. And I was at college at a time that was where there was a racial turmoil in the city of Boston. Busing had been implemented to integrate schools, and there were neighborhoods and communities of that city that I was not allowed in. I was chased out of Charlestown, Massachusetts by a mob of white students for one reason only, because I was black. I would carry a switchblade when I went to certain neighborhoods that were adjacent to all white communities. So I was coming up against kind of belonging, and as you understand from my childhood, I was accustomed to sort of being in lots of different communities, and here perhaps was the first time that I was confronted with not being allowed in because of my skin color. And I would say that that's probably why I did gravitate to the arts, because the arts gave me a opportunity to start to give voice to who I was and to the issues surrounding me. It's not to say that probably other fields might not have allowed that, But when I got into filmmaking, I started to be interested in and I started to express greatly concerns about injustice.
When you talked about the part about belonging as well, being chased by a mob, a white mob in one neighborhood in Boston, going into other neighborhoods that I assume are majority African-American where you didn't feel safe, where you didn't feel your skin color was going to necessarily make you any safer. You also had a moment even as a member of that soccer team, right? We're a member of the team and everybody counts on everybody to win the game. And then you go to a bar one night and you find out something otherwise.
Yeah, I think that probably was the turning point for me was my freshman year, being a part of the soccer team, which is a community in its own right. You need to be a team to succeed. Thinking that this group of people were my friends, going to a bar in Harvard Square and leaving for a minute and then not being able to get back in because I was black, because the bouncers at that point decided that I wasn't allowed in. And coming to the realization that when I shared that with some of my teammates who said, "What happened to you?" None of them could make sense of it. It just was not part of their consciousness. And I think at that moment, I probably was not even equipped to fully express what it felt like. What it felt like to think that I was part of something and to be told that in some ways I'm not part of something, to feel like I was part of this team, part of these guys, that they were my friends, but they didn't really understand me, that they really didn't see me, and that I even didn't have the tools to articulate that and it perhaps even begin to communicate. I'm not sure about educate, but communicate to them what that was about. And that had been really my life experience at Harvard. So look, you know, when I was chased out of Charlestown, and I shared that with people, the tendency would be, and I say white people, and I mean people, I should say white people, would be like, "Oh, really? That happened to you?" No real comprehension about the terror, about being singled out and fearing for my life simply because I was black, or having a gun put to my face by a policeman because I fit the description of a suspect for a robbery.
Did that happen?
Oh, yeah. That happened in Boston when I came back from visiting a friend at Brown outside of the Boston bus station. I mean, here's the wonderful actuality of me. I have privilege. I'm middle class. I'm a professor. I make movies. I'm African-American. There are periods of my life where I can't hail a cab. There are periods of my life where I'm followed around a store because of my skin color. That hasn't changed, and that is very much part of what I am trying to do with the work that I do.
I think you pinpointed two different aspects of this kind of expression, too. There's the sort of frustration of not being able to tell people what you're feeling, that very subjective, here's what's going on with me. But then it seems to me what I heard was there's also a frustration of realizing there's no way that it would register with you. In other words, don't you know what's happening to me, but you don't seem to be able to see that this is happening out there in the world. In the world you're living in, this is happening to other people. There's no way to kind of, you know, sort of break through that.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And I think that if I reflect on a life and really reflect on the films that I've made, the films have given me a way to articulate and represent that in a way that allows or begins to allow or invite into a room for discussion white people. And I really stress white people because I think the whole notion of racial consciousness or an awareness of difference is really a space more particularly that white males do not visit very often. So film has given me that opportunity. Back then at Harvard, I was simply trying to say this to the soccer team, and their sense was, "Well, we're all teammates. You know, we're all together. You know, we're just all one and the same." And so they were not in a place where they could see anything different. This was not their experience. They weren't going to Roxbury or Mattapan. They kind of knew that that was where you didn't go, and they would never even venture there. So, it is interesting to reflect. That certainly the experiences I had in Boston, Cambridge area were probably the point at which I coalesced with what I wanted to say and do. And because I got into the filmmaking class at Harvard, I began to find a mechanism for that expression.
Now, before that, you took a leave of absence, am I right?
That's correct. I I did take a leave of absence. I took 2 years off from Harvard after my freshman year. And I think that, you know, if I give consideration, I'd say I didn't know who I was at that point. I had meandered. College, I was essentially the first person in my family to go to college at that point. I had no models. I treated college as 13th grade. It's just where you went to after the summer. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So I had grand visions. And in many ways, the best part about that period of my life is that I didn't pursue my grand visions, which was I was going to go to Alaska to work on the Alaskan pipeline. That's how long ago it was. I was a dishwasher, a short order cook. I worked in a stock room for a jean company. I basically returned to some aspect of my roots, which was just being working class. But it was through that experience, returning to my neighborhood in New York, trying to hang out with the guys in the neighborhood, that I came to realize that I was different. Even the guys in the neighborhood made it clear. They said, you went to Harvard. We're counting on you. You are us. We need you to kind of return. And I then kind of came to terms with that I couldn't go back home in the literal sense, that home would always be with me. My essence would be there, but I had to kind of move forward. I had to forage a life.
And if the people in your neighborhood helped propel you back to Harvard, there was a professor there who I believe helped solidify your venture into film.
You know, there have been a number of adults in my life, and while I don't remember all of them, Emily Alford at City and Country, Jack, who was a counselor at Twin Link Hurley, who I wish I remembered his last name, had real profound impact on me. But certainly Chris Giromo, who has become a friend of mine, but he was my first film teacher at Harvard. And what Chris presented to me was profound intelligence, but more than anything, passion. He loved the movies. He believed in the movies as a mechanism for making change. And I guess I probably mainlined that sentiment, or it just spoke to me. And although I didn't always agree with Chris, I butted heads with him a lot. He will say to you that I was one of the only students he ever gave an A plus to, but I was hard-headed as hell. But Chris made a big difference in leading me to believe that I could make a difference with film, and he made a big difference for me even as a professor.
One of the films you made was one called From Harlem to Harvard. Tell us about that film.
From Harlem to Harvard was a film that I made in the advanced filmmaking class at Harvard. It was born out of all of us in that class had a skewed relationship with Harvard. Many of us had taken time off. And we all reflected on the reality that as freshmen, we come with this belief that Harvard is going to be everything. And halfway through or the end of it, you come to realize it's not so clear what it is, and you're less clear about how you fit in. So we came to this idea that we would explore Harvard through the experiences of freshmen, as we all had been. And in the course of casting, there was a rooming group that fit, you know, was right out of Hollywood. The first head boy at Eton, i.e. the first kind of president of the student council of Eton, who was from India, a son of an FBI director who was white, a son of a Jewish socialist, and a black kid from Harlem. They were great, but it was really George, who was the African-American student, that stood out for me based on things that I was learning. He reminded me of a character, a person in a film by Shirley Clarke. He reminded me of Jason in A Portrait of Jason. And there was something about George that spoke to challenge and crisis and conflict and aspiration, identity, that as the director of the film, I was drawn to. Now, I can't say that I fully knew that at the time. I certainly understand it now.
There's a Q&A with him at the end of this film that you have reflected on since. He's not doing so well, and you're asking him about where he is in school right now.
It was May and the end of the year. Exams were 2 weeks away. George expressed an interest in looking at his admission file. I felt that this was an opportunity to ask him some tougher questions.
Well, let me read you this here, which I just looked at. It says,
What is your opinion as to the cause of the difficulty? What is the basis of the above grade? This says Spanish A, grade D.
Yep.
George stopped coming to class before Christmas vacation, missed several weekly tests, failed to give his talk before the class. He did not come to the day it was scheduled and missed his oral interview. He received a D plus on the final. So, I mean, this tells me that you've not done the work, that you didn't even try. I mean, his attendance is poor 23 times during the semester. His attitude is poor, and he feels sorry for himself too frequently. So what about, I mean, here's someone who is your professor.
Well, at that time, I was really going through a very, very, very just rotten psychological state, because in a lot of ways, I'd given up on this place. In a lot of ways, I felt like maybe not so much that it was wrong for me to come here, but I felt this place was too much for me.
Sounds like you gave up on yourself as opposed to the place.
I had this feeling that I have a score to settle with my inner self. And I've got to make peace with my own self.
That's a clip from the film Harlem to Harvard by my guest today, Marco Williams, filmmaker and educator currently spending a year teaching at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. You've said you felt like you were a little too tough on him at the end.
You know, hearing that clip, there are a lot of things that I can reflect on in that clip. So that scene comes out of a moment of awareness by me and my film team that we were concerned that George had not really reflected on his own culpability and responsibility and sort of a kind of downfall that he experienced. So I was primed to be very hard and aggressive to ensure that he would come clean. I reflect on that scene because there are a lot of ways to read it. It's a scene where if you're just hearing the voice of the narrator, who is me, I've been told way back when that people thought that was a middle-aged Jewish man speaking to George. And it's in a moment in that scene where the camera pans and it reveals that it's actually another black person speaking to George. So now the text is quite loaded. What does it mean for a black person to challenge another black person about his weakness? Should I, as a black man, to another black man, not hang our dirty laundry out in public? Should I give him a free ride? So now the stakes of this scene are raised. And I point this out because I think of this as being very much part of the type of work that I do, that I try to tell the difficult stories, that I'm not going to hide from things. But I also learned something about filmmaking in that scene, which is a slightly different aspect of the text. I probably didn't need to be as hard on George as I prep myself to be, because he was ready to confess. He was ready to share. And so I've learned that in my own work, and I certainly know it in other scenes and sequences where I know how to be quiet. I know how to open the door to, if you will, jab, to be tough, but then to step back and let people fill the space. So I it's great that you shared that clip, because it does get me to think a lot about my own trajectory as a filmmaker.
I'm talking today to filmmaker and educator Marco Williams on the state of things. And, of course, that's a big question for documentary filmmakers, how much of themselves to bring to the film and to, you know, to what extent are you going to expose your own sensibilities about this. It is particularly true in the film In Search of Our Fathers, where it was a very personal matter for you.
That's right. In Search for Our Fathers simply is the story of my seven-year journey to learn about and to meet my father for the first time. So as I've shared in this program, I was an only child raised by my mother, some years by my grandmother and great aunts. I'm the product of a single family absent of fathers. I, at one time, close to my college graduation, wanted to know my father, part of kind of coming of age. It was a moment in my life where if I'm going to graduate from college, in some sense, I become a man. But to be a man, perhaps you need to also know your father, the kind of idea of what it is to be a father. So I set out on a journey to learn about and to meet my father. But on the course of the journey, the film became about my extended family, which was four generations of women who raised children without men in the home. So this was a way to confront a documentary program that I had heard on CBS by Bill Moyers called The Vanishing Family, Crisis in Black America. And I was sort of challenged by that notion of this pathology, this notion of pathology, what Daniel Moynihan talked about, and thinking about my own family, that at once, sure, we were examples of women who raised children without men in the home, but we were also examples of another way of seeing the family. And so in some sense, the film was way ahead of its time because it highlights the value of the extended family as a mechanism for raising children. But yes, it was a personal canvas, and that was a lot of my education at Harvard. Filmmakers like Alfred Gazzetti, Michael Rubo, Ross Melkowy was there, Ed Pincus. This was the form, and so I kind of embraced that.
Well, there's a revealing clip. It's a fine film. There's a clip, I think, that reveals some of what you're talking about. We're going to take a break, and I'm going to come back, play that clip, and talk more about it, because it also illustrates the question raised in your earlier film, who gets to ask this question? And whether or not it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan and his, you know, sort of benign neglect and a pathologizing, and even the liberal, Bill Moyers, or whether or not we can express this situation not as pathology but as a situation in our own voice. All of this, I think, shines a light on the value of documentary filmmaking. And my guest today, who is the Lehman Brady Visiting Joint Chair Professor of Documentary Studies in American Studies at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill, Marco Williams, returns with me in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with filmmaker Marco Williams, been making documentary films for more than 30 years, won an Emmy and a Peabody and a number of other awards, currently the Lehman Brady Visiting Joint Chair Professor in Documentary Studies and American Studies at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. And before the break, we were talking about the film In Search of Our Fathers that began as your search for your father and then became an extended look at your extended family. I want to play this clip, though, because, and maybe you can set it up for us, but here you found your father and you're trying to set up the first meeting. So tell us a little bit about what's led up to this.
So when I decided that I wanted to meet my father for the first time, I asked my mother, if you're going to try to find your father, you'd probably speak to your mother. And my mother kind of denied it and avoided it. And then one day she said, there's a phone call for you. Who's speaking? It's your father, my father. So that kind of set me up to want to meet him, but also begin to think about, was there a story to tell?
So you set it up. You initially in this conversation, he's agreed to talk about setting up a meeting, and then the conversation continues.
I have one other thing to ask you about concerning my visit. I'd been given a lot of thought about the fact that I had never met you and you had never met me, and that the thing that I do at school and what I hope to do when I graduate from school is to make films. And I've been thinking about how I would like to make this into a movie.
I'd be rather opposed to it.
Could you tell me why you wouldn't want to do it?
Well, I don't think it's the proper thing to do. And going into detail on that wouldn't be productive either.
I'm not sure. Well, for me, it would be productive. I mean, I guess...
Well, I understand that for me, it would be counterproductive.
Well, but... Okay. I'll accept, but I don't... Since I don't know you, I don't understand what's good for you, what's bad for you. So if you were, you were explaining that to me, would just give me a better sense of that.
I recognize your position. You have indicated that you recognize mine. Under those circumstances, that case should be closed.
Well, okay. As I said, I do recognize your position. I just don't understand it. And it's,
okay, well... There'll probably be a lot of things you won't understand in your young life.
Well,
sure of that.
That is a clip from the film In Search of Our Fathers by my guest Marco Williams, filmmaker and film educator at Duke and UNC Chapel Hill this year. What's going through your mind as you hear that clip?
Yeah, that's certainly father to son or not. there is me trying to what I said about why I was motivated to make this film. There's me trying to take those first earnest steps into the world and identify myself. And in this case, I'm trying to make films. There's also me being honest. This whole call has been recorded, filmed, and now I've shared with him that I've done that. So a kind of owning, and something I probably would have changed now in my work, but at that time, owning the ethic of, you know, that people have a right to speak to whether or not they want to be in your film, but quietly, really bummed out. I mean, at a loss. I mean, A, I wanted to make this film, and this was really important, and B, being admonished. And the way it ends is that I share that, you know, he says to call in a week or call when you're about, you know, when you have spring break, and then I made another call, and he went silent. And as it would turn out, it would be 7 years before I actually did meet him. So there's a lot in that moment for me.
What was more important to you at that moment, meeting him or doing the film?
Fair question. I would have to say that the impetus, so the starting point was I wanted to meet him. And then when I reflected on the fact that here were two adults who never met each other, didn't know anything about each other, and I was in a film program, it sort of just merged as one. I would have gladly have met him at the expense of the film. In fact, I was in Columbus, Ohio in like the third or fourth year, not far from him, no camera, a still camera, no camera. And I would have gladly have gone and met with him and had the moment, and yet he kept me at arm's bay, which is why at the conclusion of the film, I just go with a video camera and I'm going to confront the man.
It's interesting because in all of these films, and we're going to talk about the next film on this list that I'd like to talk with you about, Two Towns of Jasper, we're looking at these kind of these perceptions from my point of view, the son and filmmaker, and from my point of view, the dad, not a filmmaker. Two Towns of Jasper is a film that really and truly explores some of these very deep divisions in our perception. Tell us about that film.
Yes, Two Towns of Jasper is a film that I made with and co-directed with a filmmaker named Whitney Dow. And Whitney called me in June 1998 and said, did you hear about the dragging death of James Byrd Jr. in Jasper, Texas? I said, I had. And he said, what'd you think? And I talked about not being terribly shocked that this sort of thing has been happening. He asked me if I wanted to go down to Jasper with him because there was a Klan rally. I couldn't go. I was moving to New York. So that's backstory. But that began a conversation between us about making a film in Jasper that eventually led to an awareness between the two of us. So Whitney Dow is a white male from the Northeast. He went to Ivy League school. He worked in media. I'm a black male from the Northeast, Ivy League school, worked in media. And we had a lot of conversations about the events in Jasper, a lot of conversations about America at that time. And we invariably found that there were things that we disagreed about, and it became clear to both of us that race was the defining difference, and that led us to the decision to make a film that looked at America, looked at race in America through the prism of segregated crews. So in other words, providing a chance for black and white Americans in the town of Jasper to reflect on events in their lives, but by talking to someone who at least presumably shared something that with them, in this case, the complexion of their skin.
So the people you're interviewing, I mean, the impact on them, again, who's asking the questions and who's expecting what kind of expectations?
It's the simple way of phrasing it is that it's very different explaining something or sharing an experience. And when you're black, there's certain commonalities you have, and the presumption, of course, as well. When you're white, there's certain commonalities you have. And then, again, who gets to tell the story, how best to tell the story. In other words, whose story is it?
I want to play a clip from the film Two Towns of Jasper. This is right from the beginning of the film.
When we come down that hill walking this way, to be honest with you, I didn't see those drag marks go down this little old logging road. And we started walking, and the further we walked down that road, the more evidence we found We found the tank top and T-shirt that he was wearing. We found both of his shoes. We found his dentures. And then we found the billfold. Then that's when I knew that it wasn't going to be a hit-and-run accident. I knew it was a black man that was dead. Hoping that it was a black man that had killed him. But it didn't turn out that way.
That's a clip from the film Two Towns of Jasper by my guest Marco Williams, a filmmaker and an educator. Should set that up. Now, who is that?
So we've just heard from the sheriff, Sheriff Billy Rolls, who is white. So that's a scene that Whitney filmed with the sheriff, and that's on Huff Creek Road, which is where James Byrd had been dragged for 2+ miles until he died. It's a really important scene, and the scene that follows that is necessary to just contextualize. That's with the mortuary directors who were immediately called to pick up the body. They are African American. So in the first 3 minutes of the film, Whitney and I present the conceit, which is that there are two complementary, sometimes contradictory perspectives. The mortuary directors, what they see, they immediately know that it's racial. It's just in their instinct. Sheriff Billy Rolls at first thought it was a hit-and-run accident. He could not imagine that it would be racial. That wasn't his experience. But I always say to Whitney and Sheriff that, you know, this is just truth a point. If it wasn't for Sheriff Billy Rolls being a good law enforcement guy, realizing that it was more than a hit-and-run accident, that could have been easily swept under the rug, and it wouldn't have become what it had been, which was a modern-day lynching.
Well, you get a rare insight into his consciousness when he's telling you it. He's hoping it's not that. I didn't see it first as drag. I thought it was oil on the road. I thought, you know, you get this insight into a man who's sort of this revelation is happening against his own will, but he's telling you about it. You're getting it on film.
That's right. I think that, I think that it's one of the great. Back to what I said about my experience at the bar at Harvard. Here's a moment where the circumstances are such that being confronted with it, the person, in this case the white sheriff, it comes to terms with it. And what most importantly in this case, because he's speaking to Whitney, a white man, he's allowed to do it in a way that he doesn't feel guilt or any kind of discomfort. He feels like there's something shared in common, which back when I was at Harvard, me talking about race to a group of white students, we didn't have the language. We were not prepped. It's hard to talk about race across race.
I want to take you back to your story, because there was a moment you went to film school at UCLA. You were thinking about being a Hollywood producer and director, right?
Yeah. You know, probably all of us back in those days imagined getting a 3-picture deal before we're 30, and I came close. So, I mean, there are lots of narratives to share there. I made a short fiction film that was called Without a Pass, that was born out of the idea of the pass system in South Africa, where if you were black, you were not allowed to be in certain places without a pass giving you permission. And the fiction film is about a black man who leaves a jazz musician who leaves a club, and he's walking through a back alley during the Watts riots, and he is confronted and he is beaten and he leaves America. That led me to the opportunity to be in Hollywood. I had an agent. I had a story called The Power of No that I was going to make. About violence in the black community, based on the story of Lisa Strada. Didn't happen, and so I guess that's what they say, that's show business, or the rest is history.
Though it has come around, now you're looking, your latest project looks at, or it will look at.
That's right. It's been an interesting journey, and this show has given me a chance to kind of reflect and to kind of consider the stops on my life's journey. I am now through the largesse or the gift, the benefit of the Guggenheim Fellowship. I'm taking a look at the question of black-on-black homicide. And this story, and really the thinking of it in the most personal way, really is born out of that there were two murders in my family. My great aunt Annabelle and my cousin Warren each were murdered in Philadelphia by somebody who was black. And I'm drawn to this in no small part because there's a great clamor about Black Lives Matter, thinking about Eric Garner, Ferguson, Tamir Rice. The list goes on, and justifiably and necessarily we need to know why the police are not – why the police are killing us. But every day there are hundreds of black men who are dying through gun violence – and nobody talks about them. The only people who are concerned are the mothers in particular, and obviously certain community groups. So I want to investigate the why, the cause, but really to call attention to this human rights tragedy in our community.
Well, you're walking this line again, and as you so often do in your work, occupy this liminal space, a kind of a dangerous territory, because there are people who are concerned about that. And we've heard conservative voices raised in the light of Ferguson and in New York and Cleveland and elsewhere that why are we paying attention to these cops? If you want to know why these cops are doing what they're doing, look at how many African Americans are killing each other. These are violent communities filled with violent people. That's what they're saying.
And I can't wait, because it's so wonderful that in this case there's a notion. So black on black crime is a construct. We never talk about white on white crime or Asian against Asian crime. And so the notion of a grand statistic is both obvious if you live in a kind of community. So intra homicide is present in all communities. But our communities are not any more violent than any other communities. They're not any more crime-ridden than any other communities, but it's very easy to talk about them in this way. So I am actually looking forward to, I'm sort of taking this saying, this notion, and plan to subvert it. But at the same time, there is a crisis. The number of young black males who are shooting one another is grotesque. Can a film make a difference and change their lives? I don't know, but it is a human rights and a public health concern, and more Americans should be concerned. It's too easy to just push it aside.
I want to thank you very much. I do wish we had more time, but Marco, what a pleasure talking with you.
Wow. It went by fast. Thank you very much for having me. It was great.
Marco Williams, an award-winning filmmaker and film professor at NYU Tisch School of the Arts. He's currently the Lehman Brady Visiting Joint Professor in Documentary Studies and American Studies at Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You can learn more about him and his films at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark, the intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.